Welcome to Terra Verde and Happy New Year. This weekly environmental news program is co-produced by KPFA and the Earth Island Journal. I'm Fiona McLeod, the host and producer of today's show. And this week on Terra Verde, we have part two of my conversation with Ryan Reed, Ayuthia Lapierre, and Kyle Trefney. We are diving once again into the topic of fire resilience and stewardship with these three co-founders of the Fire Generation Collaborative. So today we're going to be speaking about their efforts to reimagine and transform fire culture by advancing policy changes that center diverse youth and Indigenous voices. We're going to be talking today a bit more about their efforts and their engagement in restoring cultural burns and Indigenous land stewardship and this shift towards developing and healing relationships between people, land, and fire. So if you missed last week's episode, you can find that at kpfa.org or on the Earth Island Journal podcast page or anywhere that you usually listen to podcasts. And I really recommend that you tune in to part one as we jump in here to pick up our conversation where we left off last week. So thank you, Ryan, Ayuthia, and Kyle again for joining me.
We're glad to be here.
Last week, we talked a little bit more about the sort of broad systemic challenges that you all and your collaborators identified, experienced, and then have been setting out to transform. So things like settler colonial policies and practices that have really translated to decades of fire suppression when it comes to land and fire management. We talked about how extraction-based economies have transformed the way that human societies in the U.S. have engaged with land and landscape. And we talked about, you know, growing up as young people in a culture that is predominantly fire-phobic in a lot of ways. And then what can be done to transform some of those conditions to push this shift towards healthier relationships with fire, to apply fire, utilize fire more on landscape in ways that really support ecosystem health, in ways that help preserve and revitalize Indigenous cultural practices. And all of this is at the center of what you all are doing in your work to advance policy shift, to organize and advocate for fire and land management that centers youth and Indigenous voices. So where we left off last week, we were just kind of getting into some of that more specific talk about the policies. So I'd love to just pick back up, Ryan, to hear about some of the specific policy advocacy that the Fire Generation Collaborative has been engaged in and some of the policy shifts that really need to happen to help heal relationships between fire and land and people.
Absolutely. So I'm the policy lead for FireGen, but Kyle and Ethi have a huge influence in growing. So as we try to collaborate on a lot of different projects we got going on, but some of the specific policies that we're focused on right now is kind of looking at how do we have that, what I have classified in a couple different spaces of this power sharing, right? And so co-management, co-stewardship is kind of those terminologies that tribes of different aspects or opportunities are looking to kind of initiate. And so, for example, there's a house bill 3444 that's, you know, it's like tribal co-stewardship and co-management and forestry act, I think is like the right full term. But that really looks about how the Forest Service can actually be authorized to give co-management capabilities, decision making, and practices to tribes, right? Currently, that's not available. And so, like, there's a lot of things that are unknown in the policy space, which our role, especially emerging in the policy space, that you have people who are spend decades and decades in and understanding the dynamics. And so a lot of times we're coming in right now and elevating what's already moving. And so that's really important for some of our policy endeavors and just looking to see how we can shape that cultural aspect. And again, I think it's the leadership on the ground, right? Who's managing, who's making decisions for how we manage and govern ourselves within land management processes. And so I think those are like some of the bigger gridlocks or that could really open the floodgates for us to be able to see change that's meaningful and that actually young people are wanting to engage. And some of our research that we've alluded to at some points actually named that Indigenous leadership is that sense of leadership that's what is wanted, that's something that they feel a little more comfortable or engaged with over time because of our role, our responsibility, and our connection to the landscapes for a geological time, right? So, there's a couple different things that we're able to help inform our policy, not just us coming into spaces and saying, hey, this is what needs to happen, but being very collaborative, being kind of looking into the history and looking into the different resources out there and being a help helping us inform those decisions to push that in the policy world. So anyways, the policy world is definitely something that fell in my lap. It's I think all of us can hear and say that. It's not something we actively sought out to do, but it's one of those things that's really important for us, especially when we're thinking about the liability, the demonization, the lack of fire on landscapes, right? So all these different things have a huge political influence, which we really had to take into account when we're trying to push these bills. We also got to have social license, we got to have community buy-in, we got to have all those things involved because of the history, the very violent nature of these large mega fires that are taking out landscapes and ecosystems as well as livelihoods and homes, right? So, there's a lot to consider when it comes to trying to move policy. And there's a lot of people out there who are doing great things. And so trying to think about those partnerships in a very collective and strategic way is really important for us. And because we don't know all the answers, but we also know that there are some answers, questions that we can answer. And so trying to make our way in the space, but also thinking about how younger generations can have direct access to what we're doing right now in a structured way is really important for us. And so we're thinking about projects, we're thinking of ideas how we can do that. Again, once we kind of leave these positions and roles that we might that we have right now is really important for us. So anyways, there's a lot to be said about the policy and how it works and how it doesn't work and what's important, what's probably not so much. But I'll kind of leave it there and digress to insert calories through the floor and gaps.
I'll just add, I guess, one little comment, that a really important aspect of the policy space that we've been working on is redefining who can be part of these spaces. And oftentimes there's this idea of there need to be experts shaping our policies, and what does an expert mean? And so one of the things that we've done is we created a subject matter expert panel of young people who are our own experts on lived experiences and on our generation. And that was part of the Wildland Fire Mitigation Management Commission that created recommendations to Congress. It was chartered by Congress, and it was really unprecedented access for younger people in this space to speak to our needs and our community's needs. And in addition, Ryan served as one of the youngest federal advisors in U.S. history on the Northwest Forest Plan Committee, amending that really significant plan for forests along the Pacific Coast. And that work is still evolving even now. But yeah, just some really important access and trying to reshape who can be in these spaces and what involvement and community participation looks like.
Thank you both. I want to invite you to dive in a little deeper if there are any examples of recent policy changes that really have moved the needle in the right direction. And also, I'm curious how the current political climate is impacting the policy work that y'all have been engaged in that extended from prior to this particular administration, at least on the federal level.
So some recent policy shifts that are really positive include recognizing and expanding the rights and ability to conduct cultural fires and prescribe fires in California with State Bill 310 from a couple years ago. You've seen similar bills in different states around the Western US, creating burn manager programs, changing the liability of being able to put good fire on the ground. You also had AB 247 this year in California that increases the pay for incarcerated firefighters. It's still not where it should be. And there's a lot of aspects of fire workforces that need to be better recognized and supported, but definitely some positive momentum. And then nationally, in the last 10 years or so, we've seen better pay for firefighters and increasing conversations around mental health and physical health as well. A lot of focus on smoke impacts to lungs this year, and a number of bills, including just recently, was passed firefighter family support for firefighters who are affected by cancer. And so these are some aspects, but as we've been alluding to in the conversation, there's a lot of more continuing transformational change that is necessary. And you can look to reports like the Wildland Fire Commission report that we were part of, and the Northwest Forest Plan Committee recommendations as great sources of what can continue to be advanced. And then also always learning from people on the ground and what they're calling for.
I'm quite interested to return to one of the topics we were kind of touching on earlier and come back to the advocacy surrounding how fire is utilized and in revitalizing cultural and prescribed burns. As we have been talking about here, fire management is a predominantly white and male-dominated field. And I'm curious, those among us who are cultural fire practitioners yourselves, to just hear about your experience personally working to revitalize cultural and prescribed burns and to shift firefighting culture away from this kind of hyper-masculine colonial militaristic norm that has defined fire management for so long in the US and abroad. So maybe Ryan or Ayuthia, if you want to speak to that.
Right. I'll kick it off. I think the first one within that is just getting people to talk about it a little bit more, right? I think there's definitely experiences in the world and what I said, mainstream society that have influenced the relationship with fire up to this point, right? Wildfires, catastrophic impacts, health disparities, maybe even family members dying on the line as a wildland firefighter, right? So there's a lot of these traumatic experiences, especially in the last 30 to 40 years, that are really intense. And so, and with that, the demonization mentality, the media, the influence of those things, and you can really get bogged down with all these news articles, all these impacts, all these issues to in a very problematic way, and where we're feeling those impacts, right? To where we get people, like as Kyle mentioned, being very fire phobic of what exactly what that is, but not really touching about why we're here. Right? Why? What made a lot of these fire-dependent landscapes and the culture around them the way that they are? Right? And so there's a lot of history that needs to be brought up and understood. Some of it's very violent. Some of it's very take you out from under your feet kind of feeling. But that's kind of one of the things that's important in what we do, right? Whether it's talking in different academic settings, workshops, classrooms, different partnerships, and really at least tickling people with that reality to being able to have their own epiphanies or understanding of why the world is the way it is. It's very strategic and it's very calculated how it is, right? There's state funding of why Native Americans in California were murdered for putting fire in landscapes, right? And what that feeling does, and not only just the impacts on the very logical basis, but that trauma that exists within communities because of it. And so I think that's one aspect that's really important to our efforts in the advocacy space, of just bringing up some of those histories and bringing up some of those things that are really influential and has really important impacts on different disciplines as well. The other aspect I'll touch on is too is just how these efforts, even though they might not be successful, especially in the policy world, of that it's changing the needle just a little bit at a time. And so we're thinking about wildfire pay. We're thinking about the health disparities, right? Things that, even though they're not really getting anywhere in the legislation cycle, for example, we're still kind of breaking down those barriers and starting to entertain those things a little bit more. It's unfortunate it's taken a century, as Kyle noted, like 1910s and 1920s is when they were first discussed. But I think that's the importance of our mission, and also our identities is really important to why that should be. People should take notice, right? People on the ground. People are impacted. People are part of the solution too. All those combination of identities and bodies are really important to consider when watching you listen to us. Well, because we've gone through it a little bit, right? We've understood. We've had to experience these things and have some level of credibility that's really important. And I think like There's so many different ways that we've leveraged in these conversations with decision makers and communities that have been helpful because of this crew. And so there's a lot of important aspects that we find real important to that. And it really comes down to how do we get more fire in the landscape at the end of the day, right? What are the issues of why we can't get more fire in the landscape, right? Let's get back to the basics of why we're celebrating 1,500 acres of burned piles when that next wildfire is going to come through and raise that whole landscape anyways, right? So it's like, okay, what's the status quo? Where do we need to go? And who are the players and people who need to be involved? This is really important, right? And so kind of elevating these things, and the people get easily caught up in the media, the Washington Post, the LA Times, right? All these things, right? And it's great to get people, some people getting determined and entering the space with like a wanting to change it, right? Or change why these experiences had in the first place. But what about the other 90% of people who are just kind of experiencing it and roll with that narrative, throughout the rest of their days, right? So anyways, there's a lot of different spheres or outlooks of how we think about that. But those are the two kind of main general areas that I find beneficial with the advocacy that we do.
Yeah, and I'll add to that that for us to have a beneficial relationship with fire going into the future and change the realities in the last 150 years of harmful interactions and memories of loss and destruction with fire, we have to be able to create a foundation of knowledge and management systems that are informed and really center Indigenous fire practitioners, because that is the center of how these landscapes were engineered and cultivated and managed for millennia. Frank Lake, who is an Indigenous scientist in this space, often talks about many of these food systems created places that, in essence, are like orchards but are not perceived in that way. Many of these trees that are productive for over 200, 300 years, have fed many generations of communities and villages and families, and are essential in how our relationship with this landscape was really centered. It wasn't about extracting capital, it wasn't about extracting a product, it was about creating a life way and a relationship with the land. It was about feeding people, your neighbors, your family. And it's a very different value system. And so, if we want to have a good relationship with fire, the best available practice and scientifically informed way of doing that is cultural burning, is beneficial relationships with fire and more than human life. And so, for us to be able to move towards that reality, we need to center the people that are not just inheritors of those practices, but also rewriting and quite literally lighting that practice. And so, because Indigenous fire practitioners, to some extent, are not necessarily framed in a very economically productive lens, right? They're not thinking about very high acreage necessarily, right? The reporting doesn't come in that way. There's a huge focus on kinship and culture and relationships, and really at the underpinning of all of that, quality burning. Right, we're really paying attention to the fire ecology and the different plant species and relationships that are intending to benefit the people and the place. And so, when you're coming from a system of management that's focused on that level of quality and those kind of species and practices and products, all of those components mean that we need to be able to shift the way that we're approaching landscape, right? And people and places. But we can't do that if we're only focused on, the workforce that has a really essential role, especially in the realities and legacy of fire suppression. But if we don't have that foundation with what this landscape has been held by, then we're missing a really fundamental component.
Yeah, you bring up a really important point that I think might be interesting for our listeners to tease out a little bit more, is the distinction between a prescribed burn and a cultural burn. Is that something that either of you would want to touch a little bit more on?
So cultural burning is a pretty complex and differentiated practice that can mean different things for different people in different families and communities, different communities, and with the tribal government lens, different nations, right? There's a legal and policy-based implication to how we use that language. I highly suggest the Good Fire 2 report created by the Kudik tribe and many of their collaborators. It does a really phenomenal job of putting a fine point on the complexity of this language and how it approaches many different ways that it's reflected on the landscape. There's also a number of people that talk about this from an experiential lens, where cultural fire, which similar to what Ryan has spoken about, is often led by matrilineal systems, feels and is very different, right? When you're there in person, these places are filled with laughter. That's one of the things that Kyle had noted coming from a wildfire background and coming to cultural burns in the Willamette Valley. There's laughter, there's children, there's elders. NWCG within fire requires wildfire, excuse me, wildland firefighters and prescribed burners to pass the pack test. And so at cultural burns, you'll often see children that are 45 pounds and in essence would not be passing a fitness test where you wear a 45 pound weighted vest, right? So there's some contradictions, or maybe not contradictions, it's an intense word choice, but there are some differences in the way that people are engaged in this practice and who is allowed to participate in which ways. And so that access is kind of a fundamental component for who is engaged and how does that reflect on the landscape, right? If we have different people of different ages and interests, capacities, abilities interacting with the landscape, you get a very diverse and, in my opinion, a highly healthy and highly productive landscape. I have been involved in prescribed fire and a number of events, and I think that the field reduction work is incredibly important, especially for structures and different needs within the community. And a lot of Indigenous communities have been working with those systems and practices to make sure that they're coming from a place of benefit to the ecosystem and the people that interact with that ecosystem. So many prescribed fires are implementing cultural objectives, which meet a lot of the needs that communities have in a different way than what's historically been implemented. Speaking from personal experience, I've seen cultural burns where people are using drip torches or propane. But I've also seen a lot of natural ignitions where that fuel and diesel is not getting put onto our wetlands, where there's thought about the hydrology on a landscape scale. And so there's some differences in the way that fire is applied. There's differences in who's involved and how people and animals interact with that place in the after. But I think it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, and refer back to the Kudu Good Fire report.
Great, thank you so much. I just have one more question, which is about bringing our listeners into the conversation and understanding what listeners might be able to do on an individual or a community level. Obviously, I'm sure this looks different in different places and for different people, but if there are broad strokes, opportunities that you all might be able to share with our listeners if they're looking to become involved in this movement to transform our relationship to fire.
Yeah, like you said, Fiona, a local approach is really essential to this work, both in the land and in our communities. We always refer back to Indigenous leadership as it's fundamental in this space. So local Indigenous and Indigenous-led nonprofits are highly important to restoring and rewriting a lot of our relationships. So supporting them in material ways, right? Whether it's volunteer time or donations or better understanding whatever individual need that organization is or group is asking for is really important. So building relationships, right? That's always an essential component of this work. And if you can refer to the local Indigenous leadership in your area, there's also a number of national groups that are really important. So if you're in California, there's also the Oakland Museum of California exhibit Good Fire Tending Native Lands. That's a really wonderful exhibit that has pulled together many different communities and practitioners and crews, many different people to help educate the public and connect the mosaic of people involved in this work. Fire Gen also created a zine at the exhibit that you can find there that focuses on policy advocacy and how you can engage in that process. Yeah, and we really appreciate getting to spend time here and appreciate that action-based question.
Yeah, absolutely. Go check out the museum exhibit and then really encourage all non-Indigenous folks like myself to see how you can use your time, energy, and resources to support Indigenous-led efforts, like Ayuthia said. It's really a essential part of being in these landscapes and being in good relationship and in honest relationship with the histories that we're all inheriting and the kind of futures that we need to realize. And so I think every person in these landscapes, especially non-Indigenous people, have that responsibility and really an opportunity to see how you can support Indigenous-led efforts in your area, and get to know and be familiar with those efforts. And we all have different kind of skill sets and different kind of things that we bring. Like, I love being an artist, and so I am often thinking about how can I use different aspects that I'm part of to contribute to these movements, but really seeing what is needed, and showing up in those ways.
Well, that's all the time that we have for this episode today. Thank you all again for joining me on the show. This has been a wonderful conversation that has spanned two episodes of Terra Verde, which is such a treat to get to welcome you onto the show for this two-part series. If you missed part one, you can find that at kpfa.org and the Earth Island Journal podcast page. I highly recommend going back to check that out. I've been speaking with Ryan Reed, Ayuthia Lapeer, and Kyle Trefney, co-founders of the Fire Generation Collaborative. If you'd like to learn more about their work, please visit firegencollab.org. Thank you three again for coming on the show. It's been such a delight to get to chat with you.
Yeah, no, it's been a treat to sit down and really have this very depth conversation about the work that we've done and where we're kind of looking forward to do, right? And so we don't get very many moments to talk, sit here and talk together like this. And so definitely an important moment for us to just reflect on some of the successes. And I'm looking at Kyle and Ethan with a smile because of all the things that we've had to do work-wise in the last month and a half. So is a lot to celebrate and a lot, but also a lot of work to do too. So really excited to sit here and take this time. I think it's a great opportunity for us to reflect. So it's been great. Thanks.
Great, thank you so much. And thank you to our listeners. Once again, Terra Verde is co-produced by KPFA and the Earth Island Journal. You can find Terra Verde on any of your favorite podcast apps, as well as kpfa.org and the Earth Island Journal podcast page. On behalf of the entire Terra Verde team, I want to wish everyone a happy new year and say thank you for following our show. We really, really appreciate your support and listening. Thanks again.